Hello and welcome back to the Sunday podcast. I'm Ollie Lum, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Seddon. This week, we spoke to distance coach Andy Hobdell. Andy's coached multiple athletes to the Olympic Games in events ranging from 1500 to the marathon. And it was great to pick his brains about his coaching and how it's developed over a number of years.
Yes, thanks for that, Lum. Welcome back, guys, for another episode. Thanks for tuning in, as always. Look, yeah, we get straight into it with Andy, and we talk about the Tokyo Marathon. And, you know, what a major Olympic marathon is actually like. And, you know, Andy says they probably don't get the respect they deserve. You know, he rightly says there's 150 guys who've run sub 2:11:30 or inside that, you know, a similar qualifying standard to get there. You know, you don't get that kind of depth in a major marathon. You really don't. So, you know, finishing 50th or whatever is still a huge achievement. So, yeah, he talks about that, and he talks about preparing for the heat in Tokyo. A lot of Europeans, in my opinion, they didn't really use heat chambers. I mean, obviously, I don't know everyone's training regimes before Tokyo. But yeah, a lot of Europeans neglected it, and they chose to go to altitude and just get in really good shape, when running in the heat is a completely different ballgame. As Andy would allude to and tell you all about. And, you know, interestingly, we talked to him about sort of coaching and how to get athletes out of a rut, and whose fault is it if they do get injured or they are underperforming. So he's got an interesting take on that. And of course, we talk about Andy Badley, his career, that 2008 season where he really hit like a sweet spot, and how a coach can kind of almost plan for the perfect season. So he lets us know his thoughts on that. And then finally, of course, we talk about a parkrun world record. We talk about Andy Badley's form, and we talk about the running mechanics. You know, how important are running mechanics? How do we change them? And... you know, how can we use certain mechanics to our advantage? Which, interestingly enough, Badley's style, Hobdell thinks, did play into his advantage in a certain way. So listen out for that. But yeah, you know, that's pretty much it. We talk a lot in between and around those topics. So look, enjoy the podcast, guys, and thanks. And yeah, as I said last week, we're nearing big 50. So yeah, Cardiff Cross Challenge this weekend, so I'm going to be there filming. Hopefully we get a few shots up on the Instagram, keep the feed updated for you guys. So we may do a cheeky review on that after, because me and Ollie are both going to be there, so we can probably accurately review that race, start the Cross Challenge series, start the World Tour. Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation, this World Tour. But yes, okay, take care, enjoy the podcast, and we'll catch you next week.
Right, Andy, first of all, just welcome to the podcast and thanks for coming on. We just wanted to start really with Tokyo, because obviously it's still quite recent. You had two athletes, I believe, obviously Paul Pollock and Kevin Seaward in the marathon. How would you kind of assess how the race went and just the overall experience of the games?
Okay, well, you know, let's be absolutely clear to begin with. You know, an Olympic marathon, the qualifying time was 2:11:30. The marathon itself was delayed by a year. So you yourselves as athletes will just look at that scenario and think to yourself, okay, so the first issue is, one, I've got to get the Olympic qualifying time. Two, I've perhaps got that 2 years before I'm actually going to have to race it. And so then you need to keep yourself ticking over and then bring yourself to a peak, which is 2 years after you've actually run the qualifying time. So those are the issues as a coach and as an athlete that, you know, those are the types of hoops we had to jump through to begin with. And then, of course, as we all know, there was all of the media coverage about whether or not the Olympics were going to take place. So the marathon is a 16-week, a 20-week, or however you decide to prepare for it. It's that type of structure that's required to then get you to a peak on race day. Now, that's not an easy thing when you've got someone who's knocking out 120 miles a week and having to prepare for what is going to be the most unique and special event of your life, even at that point, not knowing if the race is going to take place. COVID, all of those things that we've had to deal with over the last 18 to 20 months, have just made it a very unique, one of the most difficult races to prepare for. But then you get to the start line, and there's all of the preparation that goes into getting you to the start line, but you've basically got 150 runners approximately who've all run 2:11:30 or quicker. Now, you know, you tell me a major.
Yeah, that's a good point.
you know, that has that type of quality. So, you know, after the race, when you get someone who says, oh, where did you come in the marathon in the Olympics? You say, oh, 56. And they're, oh, that wasn't very good. Well, hold on. Let's get some context on that. You know, you had to run 2:11:30 to be in the bloody thing, you know, and then you're racing against 150 other guys who prepared themselves to the max to be in race shape, to be even faster than 2:11:30. So that, you know, that's quite a thing, isn't it? If you think about it. And I think that, you know, this year the marathon was perhaps one of the best quality marathons ever. It's just a great shame in some ways that it was in such difficult conditions. Otherwise, I think we'd have seen quite a different race maybe.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Actually, I think that does get overlooked, the fact that everyone there has, you know, run 2:11:30 or quicker. And there's, like you say, 150 of them. One thing I wanted to ask you about is, I think it was well documented that your guys, you know, Kevin and Paul, they did a bit of heat work. And I didn't really see much from the Europeans, and it did surprise me, you know, in preparation. I think it was because of COVID, but, you know, we spoke to, you know, people like Steph Twell and Tomo and stuff before, and they didn't factor in heat training too much. And I think surely, you know, going out there, you needed to. And it was something, you know, when I was doing a bit of research for this, I saw that you did do, but you took a slightly different approach with Kevin and Paul, didn't you?
Well, no, I mean, okay, so look, a little bit of an insight to how I prepare for a race. One, you look at the conditions that you're going to be running in. So if you think back to when Kevin ran in the Commonwealths and he finished fourth there, and you look at how hot it was for that, it was what, 35 degrees?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was just ludicrous. And when people start to talk about what sort of pace you're going to run, you look at past experiences in that type of climate as regards what sort of times you're needing to run to get where you want to be, you know? So it was, we all knew that to prepare for Tokyo, the types of conditions you were going to be running in were just ludicrous. The humidity, so from the training camp through to the actual marathon, the guys were training in the 3 weeks before at the pre-camp, they were basically training what? Anything between 25 and 33 degrees, but anything between 50 and 70% humidity. You know, which is just bonkersness. So to prepare for that, we were lucky. Paul was over in Ireland, so he was able to go into the Centre of Excellence there and do some chamber work. I could read you out some of the text messages after some of that chamber work. But, you know, let's be honest, you know, so to be anywhere at the marathon, you had to be running 5 minute miling and that type of heat, you know, those conditions. And I don't mind telling you that we were running perhaps no more than 60 minutes, 2 to 3 times a week in the heat chamber before heading out to the pre-camp. And the experiences were just vomit-like fashion. You know, it was, you know, here I am, I'm jogging in a heat chamber, trying to copy those conditions, and I'm not even breaking 6 minute mile pace. You know, and you're dead on your feet. So it was like that to begin with, but then as it progressed, you know, doing it 2 to 3 times a week on your easy days, just to start to get that acclimatization going on, just to, you know, increase the blood plasma levels in your body, just to get the inner core more used to all of those sorts of temperatures, it paid off. Because when they went out to do their pre-camp with the Irish team, it took us about four maybe 5 days of easier running out there before the boys started really dropping into the types of sessions that they were doing back here. And that's a good sign, because look, you know, if you can't run that type of intensity in those types of conditions, then there's no point being on the start line. You know, you've lost before you've begun. So you've got to prepare. So we did quite, I wouldn't say we did a lot of it, but we did, I believe, enough, because it's very tiring, you know?
Well, in terms of Europeans, they did actually finish quite high up, didn't they?
Yeah, and they did well. I mean, Kevin, I think we had a strategy to get him in the top 30. But for him having an issue with his abductor in the last 5K, he was coming through for that, because his second half was, you know, I think, I mean, if you're like me, you stayed up till silly o'clock to watch it, then you saw him and Chris Thompson hook up and they were starting to come through quite nicely, you know. So, yeah, almost, you know, and it's, you know, yourselves, you know, as athletes, that you have a plan, you have a strategy, you execute the strategy and you believe it's the right one. It was almost there for Kevin, almost. Mm. But it was never going to be a top 10.
Mm-hmm. On those kind of, as a coach then, on those like almost days, like almost the right strategy, is that is almost the right strategy or almost executed it well enough? How do you guys, kind of yourself and Kevin, dissect that afterwards?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I mean, I think, in fact, I know we had the right strategy. We discussed it a lot. And there's a very fine line. And you know this. I mean, do you guys do the marathon yet? You look too young to be doing the marathons yet.
Not yet.
We haven't touched it, mate.
Yeah, you look like speedsters to me. So, you know, there's a line, okay? And if you cross that line too early in the marathon, then it's not going to happen. And so you're almost nudging that line all the way through your race plan, your strategy. And then you can, it's only really kind of in the last 10K that you can almost start to feel you can push a little bit beyond that. So it's almost like an elastic band effect. You just got it, but you don't want it to break, you know? So with Kevin, we assessed it after, and the only issue was the abductor, which is something that we couldn't do anything about. So aside from that, very happy with how things went. Yeah, you know, and again, not forgetting, you know, it's the best runners in the world. It's, you know, immense by way of talent and quality.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, something I wanted to touch upon is we've seen a few athletes try and bounce back off the back of Tokyo. You know, we've seen them, you know, rush to these major marathons, and some have had success, but the majority have obviously struggled. What would you advise, you know, a little bit of advice to other people, you know, post-marathon, like what's the best recovery strategy?
Well, the best recovery strategy is to go and have a beer. and I think the joke with me and Kevin is we normally turn around and say, right, have you had your burger yet? You know, yeah. Because look, preparing for the marathon, it's a long journey, and people perhaps think they recovered from marathon, but you're not. Mentally, it takes a lot out of you. It takes a huge amount out of you. You know, to maintain that type of intensity over 26.2 miles, it's a hard job. And I always deal with it afterwards by basically just being laid back, kick back, you know, take a few weeks off, no rush. Probably one of my phrases I always use is that there's no rush. You know, let's just take our time, because if you come back too soon, you have a bad performance. That sets you back even more. Mm. You've got, you know, it's all about allowing your body to recover, but also allowing the mind to recover. So take your time. You know, you've got a half a ton of aerobicness, good aerobic work in there. That just doesn't disappear. So once you let your body come back to itself, let your body juice itself back to where it wants to be, wow, you can really start to push on. But you've just got to be mindful. You've just got to be careful. And you just got to say to yourselves, look, there is no rush. And, you know, have that burger, have that beer, and just take your time. You know, your body will naturally tell you when you're ready to start running again or to start doing any type of intensity and training again. But I particularly do not rush. I occasionally, Paul Pollock's a classic, Paul's always desperate to come back and do more. And I'm just saying, look, why are you rushing? Seriously, you're an Olympian for the second time. Let's just take our time, have a few months off, like he's doing now, focusing on the European cross. You know, it's take your time. You're not going to rush back and then suddenly run a 5-minute PB for your marathon after a marathon that you've done only 6 weeks before, you know, or whatever. It's taking too much out of the body. That's my view anyway. And I would just encourage people to go the other way and after the marathon, take your time, recover, but then look towards doing more faster work, you know, improve your 5Ks, your 10Ks, do the fun stuff, you know, get your mojo back, really start to feel that hunger again. And then with my guys, we naturally do that 5K, 10K, half marathons is the end of that kind of part of the process. And then they're saying, I want to run a marathon. You know, they've got that hunger, that desire to do it. And that's what you need. You can't just say, I'm going to do a marathon. You've really got to want to do the marathon. Mm. You know, that's the thing. So yeah, no rush. I'm waffling, but yeah, no rush.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned kind of them wanting PBs then, and obviously you yourself have coached a few guys to kind of 210, obviously under that 211.30. And we obviously saw we had three Brits, three from Ireland in the Olympic marathon. How are we going to see UK-based athletes start producing these kind of 2.8s, 2.9s, maybe even quicker on kind of a regular basis? What's it going to take for us to almost catch up to some of the quicker nations, if you like?
Okay, well, let's first of all think about it. So Kev Seward works full-time. Paul Pollock, he's a doctor, so he works part-time, semi-full-time. Mm. To be world-class, to be that type of runner, it's a full-time job. Mm. You know, come on, let's be honest. We're not able to be like the Kenyans, for example, who have got hundreds at their camps, who are basically flogging it out day in, day out, at a chance of going to a major marathon. We don't have that. You tell me where they, you know, you look at Cardiff, you look at Birmingham, you look at Leeds, you look at our hubs that we have. We don't have that type of talent in depth. And it's even just looking at the basics. You look at our 5K, our 10K para 10 lists, all right? You show me, and I've done my research, like you guys, to be that type of runner. So Mo ran, what, 26:46 for 10K? And he's our only 205 runner, isn't he?
Mm.
You know, so how many other athletes do we have under 27 minutes for 10K? We don't.
Well, yeah, none.
Right. How, and then just take another step back. How many athletes do we have under 28 minutes for 10K? It's not that many.
No.
You know, we've got some great talents there.
More now, but yeah.
You know, you've got people like Mark Scott, Sam Aitken, Patrick Deva.
He's done it.
Look at some people. Yeah, Emil. You've got Charlie Hicks. You've got those types of people who are knocking out 27s. But do they want to do the marathon?
Mm.
You know, so we need to start looking at improving our 5K, 10K talent pool. Once we can improve our 5K, 10K talent pool, then we can progress it, can't we? How many half marathon runners do we have under 61 minutes?
Yeah, very, very few. I mean, Smith and Connor off the top of my head, you know what I mean? Obviously Hawkins and Farah, but yeah.
You know, and I mean, Jack, I mean, look, I'm a fan of Jake. I mean, you know, I'm loving what James and Jake are doing. And, you know, Jake's got huge potential for that. You know, touch wood, he stays healthy.
Mm.
You know, but it's quite a thing to progress from 210 to being a 205 person, because you need to have that basic kind of 10K time, which is around about 27 and a half, edging down to 27 minutes. That's kind of what you want. You know, there's some of the old timers who were knocking out your 2.8s, 2.9s, and they were running what, 28s, 28 and a halves for 10K.
Mm.
So it can be done, but to get down to your 205s, 206s, we're going to need to increase our talent pool, 5K, 10K, and then really then ensure they have the right coaches to do the right type of work to then progress that through to being that type of marathon, which can be 205, 206.
Yeah, I think that's similar to what me and Ollie discussed in a previous episode. Was I think maybe the 206, 207s are going to come with, like you say, the guys running at the moment. You know, I think you've obviously seen Mark Scott. I think he's got quite a talent, you know, quite a big future on the road. He seems to be enjoying the halves as it is.
Yeah, I mean, the thing for Mark is, you know, he's got great speed. You know, he really is that type of talent.
Yeah.
But let's also not forget, you know, how much it costs to do a marathon. You know, you can only probably do one, maybe two a year, you know. So therefore, for those guys who are doing this full time, you've got to look at what sponsorship, what backing they've got, what support they've got. How much are they going to earn from doing that marathon to justify them taking 16 weeks out from a track or a more profitable road program to do a marathon? You know, these are huge factors and people sometimes forget this. But, you know, if you're going to be, what, maybe 10th in a race and run 207 or 208, how much is that going to back you for the rest of the year? Mm-hmm. When if someone like Mark Scott could probably do the 5K, 10K road circuit and make quite a lot.
Yeah, well, interestingly, I was reading an article on that's kind of how they work out and pay appearance fees, is on the sense that you are committing to their race. So like you say, it will be, you know, during the build-up, it will be kind of a loss of earnings in that sense. That's why marathoners typically have much bigger appearance fees than most other road races.
Correct. And, you know, and but if you think you can only do what, one, maybe two a year.
Yeah, as well.
You know, that's a slight issue, isn't it? But I don't see any reason why we can't get down to 2.5s, 2.6s, 2.7s at all. There's great talent, but society's changed, hasn't it? You know, it's kind of, you've got to say to younger people coming through, if you want to do the marathon, you've got to do this. I think there aren't too many people out there who necessarily want to go and be that 2.05, 2.06, 2.07 person and realize what it's going to take out of them to do it.
Yeah.
It's a special thing. I mean, look, we all know how special Mo was, and there were such high hopes of him, you know, being that man at the marathon, but it requires a different type of running. His running action had to be changed for the marathon, you know, and then when he came back to the track, his running action was different to what it used to be on the track. So it was not what it was, you know, and he found it harder. So yeah, there's a lot of compromises that would need to be made for people to do it. But I believe that, yeah, we have the talent in this country to do it for sure. But will they have the backing, and do they necessarily want to do it? Because, you know, the chances of getting injured in the marathon prep, high. Chances of getting ill in marathon prep, high. You know, so there's every chance that you could aim for doing that marathon. You'll never make it to the start line because you're pushing your body to the limits.
Yeah, well, we'll touch upon that. And one thing we wanted to touch upon, like you said, you're coaching Kevin and Paul who are working full-time and part-time. Do you use altitude training? How important do you feel altitude training is for, you know, because there's an argument kind of coming recently, is it that beneficial for the untrained runner or the person who doesn't use it frequently?
I mean, look, I'm an advocate of all of this. So guys, have you ever trained at altitude?
Yeah.
Okay, how did you find the first 5 days?
Pretty rough.
Okay, and how long were you at altitude for?
I've been at altitude for, you know, 4 or 5 weeks or just like 2 weeks even. So
okay, so
yeah,
so
different stints.
Where are your special days when you come back down?
I mean, for me, it was the biggest thing at altitude was the recovery. And I would say after a couple of weeks, that has kind of gone and I just go back to feeling normal again. Didn't seem to last that long.
Yeah, but there's that window of opportunity
Yeah,
that time at altitude. So where were your windows of opportunity for you?
Probably after I'd got over the travel and whatnot, probably like a week in.
Because why I'm saying this is that people go to altitude and go, oh, I'm going to run well when I come back down to sea level. Doesn't quite work that way because everyone is different about how they respond to altitude. So it's not a one size fits all thing. So, you know, you need to do it a lot to be able to understand where your window of opportunity is. Is it that initial 24 hours? Do you come down from Font-Romeu down to race, go back up, which works quite well, as we all know? Or is it then 3 to 4 weeks after? You know, and then of course you have that real downside, which is you can go to altitude, you can overtrain and overreach. And so therefore you're knackered for months after, you know? So it's a process. Do I think altitude training works? If you do it a lot, yes. If you get your equation right, yes. You've got to do it a lot. I think you've got to be up there for at least, you know, 10 to 11 months of a year.
Wow.
Well, look, think about it. You know, you're going up, you're coming down. You're going up, you're coming down. You've got to be up there for that much. If you're just taking a flavor and coming back, you're not going to get the true benefits. Like you did, you went for 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah.
So how long did that last for you?
Yeah, I'd probably say a maximum of like 2, maybe stretch it to 3 weeks.
Yeah. So do you see my point? So you've got to do it on a regular basis. So do we have a protocol that allows for that? No, we don't. The Federation were, as you know, for a while doing the, oh, we'll go up to I-10, you know, 3 weeks before the European cross country trials. Do you remember that, when that was all going on? And so they take a whole load of people up to I-10. They do 3 weeks of altitude, come down for the European cross country trials. Yay, some would run well, some wouldn't. And then it was a question mark about whether they would be good then for the actual European cross country championships if they qualified, you know? But then what happens after that? Are they going to take them back up? Have they got the backing to go and give them more altitude? Or is that it? So if you're going to do it, you've got to commit to doing it. If you're not, then I would say just don't do it, because it's going to mess up your training. It's going to mess up your recovery. Your body, the physiological side of your body will get confused, which is not a good thing for an athlete, you know? So I just think you have to be mindful of all of those factors before you decide that you want to go and do altitude. You know, I look after young athletes, and, you know, they're doing PEX at school, they're studying, and they say, oh, Andy, are we going to go and do altitude training one day? And I said, okay, why would you want to do that? And they say, oh, because it's going to turn me into a world-class runner. Okay, so maybe training 10% harder might do more. Mm. You know, so the other way of looking at it is, if you're running 120-mile weeks, if you've been an international for X amount of time, you're looking for percentages in improvement that can make the difference. So then, yeah, if you spend a bit more time at altitude and get your plan right and execute it well when you come back down, it can make a difference. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so interesting, because I think it's become such a, almost just a fashionable thing to do in recent years. I think how it's become a bit more, say it's probably become a bit more accessible in terms of, I guess, the cost of it. It seems everyone is doing it, and it's almost just the done thing, and people don't question the other side of it in terms of how it affects you, how you have to change your training and things like that. Or people don't bother, and then they're cooked once they come back, because they don't even think about how to change their training around it.
Yeah, and it's a funny thing, altitude. I mean, you know, it's a hard time when you're up there as well. Don't lose sight of that. I mean, it's quite an existence, isn't it? Those first 4 or 5 days are quite a, ooh, why am I breathless? What's going on? You know? So it is quite a thing, but yes, it is accessible. The Americans use it a lot because it's a lot more accessible to them, about where they set themselves up. Where do we tend to go? It's more low level altitude. So you're more looking at Samaritz, Font-Rameau, those types of things, or you end up going all the way to Kenya, or over to the States, don't you? So yeah, it's an interesting one. I would say if you're looking for that extra couple of percent on your performance and you can commit to it, yeah, it's a good thing to do. But if you can't, then I would focus on training harder and training more intelligently and then getting the most out of it from that side of things. Because
yeah.
I think most people, if you take them back and look at their training schedule, you can probably show them they can make significant gains just by training correctly. You know, let's be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I saw a thing saying, you know, elite athletes, they sleep 30% more, they eat 30% better, and they train 30% harder, you know, so do things proportionally to that. You know, we often just think, oh, we've got to train, you know, twice as hard. You know, they're just ahead of us because they're training harder, but most of the time there's other areas as well.
Yeah, and I think for me, you know, having been fortunate to have coached some people to the kind of the elite end of our sport, it gives me a better insight when I get youngsters come through, because they have this false impression of what they've got to do. And so it's really nice to be able to say to them, I said, well, look, you don't need to do that. You know, cut through the crap. Let's just do this. And they're like, oh, but don't I need to train twice a day now? No, you're 14. You know, do you know what I mean? And it's kind of, you know, but I need to go to altitude. No, you don't, not yet. You know, or no, it's not part of, you know, it's all those types of things that you can just debunk it all for them, which I think makes life easier for them. And look, just because you didn't win your schools this year, your life is not over. You know, you're only 15, you came fourth. It's about what you are as an athlete when you progress through the junior ranks and the progression to becoming an international as a senior. That's what we're working towards. This is all part of that journey. And it's been really good to kind of say to youngsters, look, it's not everything just now. This is part of the process. Let's just bring you through and do the right things, keep you healthy. The more athletes we can keep in our sport, keep enjoying our sport, then the greater opportunity we have of keeping that talent in who's going to be world-class and world champions.
Mm, 100%. I think just like back on the marathon a bit, I think you mentioned it earlier about kind of there's different lengths of build-ups. Do you have an ideal length of build-up, if you like, or is it different for each of your marathoners?
Yeah, I mean, look, all of you guys, all of you athletes are very special, you know, and you all need to do things slightly differently because it's a subjective approach. It's not one size fits all. But I have the way I like to look at things is I have what I call pre-marathon prep, which is roughly around about 4 months where, as you've heard, I said already, we focus on the shorter distances, you know, getting your mojo back, getting your hunger back for doing the marathon. So we focus on the 5Ks, the 10Ks, getting your times as quick as we can. And then we finish off that phase of work often by running a fairly fast half marathon. And then that leads us into them doing what I call marathon specific prep work. And that can vary depending on the athlete between 10 weeks through to 20 weeks. And that's the kind of length of program that you're looking at.
I want to talk about, do you think an athlete has to do half marathons or 10Ks in their build-up? Do you think sometimes we over-race? We're guilty of that?
Yeah, and if you studied any of my guys' racing strategies, you see that they don't race a lot. Hmm. Because of that very fact that, you know, one of the first questions I often get from people is, you know, you don't race much in the marathon prep phase, i.e. that 16 week into the marathon. I said, yeah, we don't race. And they said, well, why don't you race? And I said, well, look, if you race bloody hard, how long is it going to take you to recover? Mm. You know, and if you race a 10 miler or a half marathon, it takes you what? A week to 10 days, maybe 2 weeks to recover after that. So you're biting into invaluable marathon prep time when you could be doing the mileage, doing some quality sessions, doing that type of work. So if you're going to run a half marathon, run it as, you know, as I get my guys to do, you know, maybe just do a marathon pace. It's a marathon pace session. Run it at 65 or something, or 64 and a half. But don't thrash your guts out to run 63 or try to get down to 62. Let's just do it as a steady run, 65, 64 and a half.
Yeah, I'm just going off Kipchoge. And obviously, his camp seems to be very, very good. You know, they don't go to any races or anything, and they just appear on the start line in supreme condition.
Yeah, but, you know, think about it. If you're doing sessions in that marathon prep day, say 24 times a K, you know, for example.
Yeah.
Which is a standard type session. It's going to take you 2 or 3 days to recover after that session before you move on to your next piece of work, which might be anything from a 30K to a 24-mile run. You know, so you can't race in that phase, because when you stress your body with racing, you have greater opportunity of injury and illness. Whereas if you're on that fine line, which is just trying to get the most of you in the training to prep you for the day that matters, which is race day, you want to make sure you do it right. And perhaps overstepping the mark by racing doesn't help. Also by racing, it puts you mixing with other people as well, doesn't it? You know, certainly through COVID, it's all about trying to keep away from people, you know, keeping yourselves healthy. Don't put yourself at risk of potentially getting ill, you know. So, yeah, sadly, I'm not one of those coaches that advocates a lot of racing. And it's the phrase I tend to use is, let's just stay under the radar and turn up on race day, which I think is quite good for a lot of people, because you don't need to show it before race day, because that's the only day that matters.
Yeah, and then also you've got the mental aspect of, you know, something I find quite interesting is that as a coach, whose fault is it, if you like, when, you know, someone underperforms or has a bad day?
Yeah, that's always my fault. You know, I'm one of those, you know, sadly, you know, I'm one of those coaches that I don't stop analyzing what we do. It's I analyze each and every day. I analyze each and every session. Yeah. And if something doesn't go right, I will go back and I'll work out why it didn't happen. You know, if an athlete decides to, you know, go off race plan and do something absolutely stupid, like run a, you know, a 4:16 mile or something at the start. Well, I'm sorry. It's like, You know, I'll be at the end with a big stick, you know. That's not my problem, but I prepare the athlete to race and we agree on a race strategy and a race plan. But if it doesn't work, then we, you know, as a team, you know, you sit down and you try and work out why it didn't work. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'll give you a little insight. I remember Badders in his early days, he qualified for the Europeans indoors. Yeah. And it was at Madrid, which is very slightly at altitude, you know. And I overcooked him going in. And it was just awful. He was cooked in the first round, you know. It's an interesting thing because I found him. In fact, the first person I found was Mark Rowland. He didn't qualify for the final. The first person I found was Mark Rowland. He's a good friend of mine. I love what Mark does. He's just a professor of our sport. And Mark saw me and he just put his arm around me and he said, Andy, so I was a very young coach at this stage. He said, look, this is where you earn your stripes as a coach. This is where you come back as a coach. Now go and see your boy over there. Badders was sat down, he was in a heap, he was crying, it was just awful. Yeah, I went down, just sat with him, put my arm around him, and I said, we'll never do this again. And it's about learning from your mistakes. It's about learning, working with an athlete, what makes them better. And you're a team, you know. I'm not that type of coach that's, oh, it's me. I'm that person who is, if my athletes perform, that's all I need. You know, if they enjoy their sport, that's all I need, you know, because that's why I do it. I do it simply to help someone, an athlete, to perform to the best of their ability so that, look, let's be honest, none of us get rich from this sport. The only things we get rich with are memories, you know. You will look back on a race, you will look back on a time, you'll look back on a competition or a training session and you'll have a smile on your face. You know, do you remember that? That's why we do it. You know, we're rich in those types of memories. And if I can give someone those type of memories that they look back at some point in the future and say, do you remember when Andy did that and gave us that session? Oh, you know, you know, it's priceless, you know, come on.
Yeah.
For sure. No, it's so interesting. It takes us on nicely because, we wanted to highlight, obviously, we chatted about the marathon a lot, but not just a marathon coach yourself and like not always just been a marathon coach. Obviously, working with Andy Baddeley, one of Britain's kind of finest milers of all time, really. Do you have any kind of reflections on that in terms of, obviously, you mentioned probably one of the lows there, but obviously, Andy ran a 3:49 mile, main Olympic final. How do you get an athlete to the peak of that sort of level?
It's a long process. You know, all of you guys know that everyone's looking for a quick fix session or a quick fix to reach the top. It isn't. It's, you know, anyone that comes to me and they sort of say to me, I want to be this athlete. And I say, do you know what? Yeah, I think we could probably get you there, but it's not going to take 6 months. It's not going to take a year. You're looking at 3 or 4 years to get you to that level. And that's how it was with Badders. I mean, he approached me initially. I was on a training camp and he was on that camp. And an athlete I coached at the time, Mark Draper, was there. And I got to know Badders there. And then he went to Cambridge University as a bit of an academic. Mm-hmm. And he contacted me from Cambridge and he said, Andy, I'm the captain of the cross country team. I've got no idea what training I should give them. You know, so I started sending across training schedules. And then he then asked me to coach him. And I always remember, and you guys are going to laugh at this, I set him a threshold session to do. And he came back at me and said, what's that? You know, it was just like, you know. And I always remember he went out to just try and do this session. And like everyone does, he ran too fast and couldn't finish it. You know, and that's the learning curve. That's, we started, he wasn't training twice a day. He wasn't doing high mileage. He was just slowly but surely eating into that curve of adding those extra bits of training that start to build you towards where you need to go. I can remember when he broke the 4-minute mile in our first 12 months. That was a great thing, you know, but it was just a process. And I remember saying to him, I said, look, for me to be a world-class miler, you need to break 350 for the mark. And he's, and he carried that with him. That we said that in the first year, he carried that with him right until he ran the 349. He said, well, in my coach's eyes, I'm now a world-class miler, you know. But it's a long process, and it took, you know, I started working with him in what, 2003, 2004? So that gives you an idea of how far and how long it took to get to 2008. And then you're looking at the changes in mileage. He was starting off with what, 25, 30 miles a week? And then by the time you're looking at 2008, he was on what, 95, 100 mile a week?
As a 349 miler.
Yeah. And he was knocking out his 10K thresholds were probably what, 29 and a half?
Wow, pre-super shoes.
You know, so, you know, it's that type of, you know, if that gives you an idea. And then I think it was around by that sort of time, he ran what, 7:39 3K. So you have to be strong to be fast. And that's something which a lot of people forget. They just think, oh, you know, Seb Coe, all he did was speed training. No, he bloody didn't.
Yeah.
You know, he was a guy that could go out and do a 10 miler in 50 minutes. You know, there was a lot of work in there.
Do you think we get these, like, these running myths? I think Matt and I actually chatted about this just last night. Do you think we get these running myths like Seb Coe just did speed, or you don't always need mileage, or so? Do we think we just get these because of a lot of lazy people out there who almost want to spread these quick fix solutions to just not wanting getting out and doing some hard work sometimes?
No, and yeah, I'm absolutely right. You know, half of my career is spent talking to youngsters and those coming through and debunking them and saying, look, that's not correct. That is not correct. Yes, you know, and if you look out there, the number of times I've gone out and given lectures to people, and I said, why am I here? And they said, well, I said, surely you can go and read all the answers in a magazine or look online and find all your answers to see how you run a marathon or run a fast 1500. So why am I here? I tell you why I'm here, because I'm going to tell you what works. Yeah, I'm going to tell you what it does take to do that. That you don't go out and run a fast 400 and then go and run 145 for an 800. You know, let me talk, you know, let's talk about the full-time occupation you've got to get to become a world-class athlete. Now, if you're prepared to commit to that, then potentially you can do it. But not a lot of people want to commit to what is the reality of becoming world-class or the best that they can be, because it requires a lot of commitment, as you two both know. It's not just a couple of 5 mile runs in a hill session or whatever. You know, you've got it's a 24/7 thing. And people don't realize that. The reality is quite hard to bite on sometimes.
Yeah. And on the basis of that, I mean, I'm fascinated to hear that 2008 season that Badley did have, almost from like start to finish, because I think, you know, what makes a good season, you know, what should athletes and coaches consider when they're looking for, you know, a very complete season? How do you plan for that?
Yeah, and everyone approaches it differently. But if you look at Badder's standards kind of a season, we'd drop indoors and have a short indoor season so that you get to spin the legs out, even when you're doing high mileage. So he would often go in and do the New Balance mile, run that in what, 356, 55, he'd win that. And then maybe do a little bit of a European indoors. And then we come back out after European indoors and then basically load back up and then prepare ourselves for the summer season. But as you guys know, with things like having to get Olympic qualifying times and things, your season, the way you plan it can change. So it's very useful to go out to the States and have an early collegiate season on the track with those great quality races which they have out there to get your Olympic qualifying times. So it's very, you need to look at what your objectives are. You need to look at what you want to peak for and then just plan back from those dates as regards what you need to do to get those things. And that's the way that I strategize over a year for an athlete, is looking at those key dates where we need to peak for, and then it's about planning back from there about what we need to do.
And then on that 2008 track season itself, you know, when you're planning the races, do they just snowball? Do you use the races to your advantage?
Of course you do. I mean, you'll look back, for example, a standard thing for us is, so the Oslo Dream Mile was always part of the season. But then a couple of weeks before that, we'd always do an 800.
Yeah.
You know, because spin the legs out. He wouldn't be doing sharpening work. He wouldn't have done fast work for that. That would be very much just to have that flood of lactic in the 800 towards the end there, just to then 2 weeks after, you feel good for a mile. It's about having the sharpening effect from racing to then progress you onto your next race, which I'm sure is how you guys do it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't beat that competitive environment of a shorter race before you do a longer race. You know, if you're racing a 5K, it's quite nice to have a 1500 or a 3K in there. It's all about just planning your races so that you basically are just building and building and building to when you need it.
So, did Andy surpass your expectations that night?
Do you know, it's a really funny thing. I know you guys have probably heard the story and everything else, but it was just really nice as a coach to have had what was no injuries, no illness, you know, none of those things that the other hoops to jump through, to have week on week of just ticking the boxes of the training that we wanted. Tick box, done that, tick box, done that. He did a time trial K, which is how we normally finish the pre-track phase. And he ran 218, 219 time trial.
Wow.
So it was coming together. And that was really helpful because, I'll tell you the quick story. You know it anyway. So we're at the Oslo Dream Mile. I'm there in the stands. I don't often get to go to meetings, cost money. So I was there at Oslo. And Badders had gone off to do his warm-up. And Tom Lancashire had run a little bit earlier and had just run a really fast 1500, 3:33, something like that. Okay. And I'm there, and I'm there with Collis Birmingham and a few of the Aussie guys, and the phone goes, and I'm like, I won't swear, but what are you calling me for? So I picked it up, and he said, can I have a quick chat? I'm like, oh, yeah. All right. And so I jogged down underneath the stadium at Oslo, and he's there, he sat down, and I was saying, I just walked up to him and said, what do you want? And he looked at me, and he goes, oh, Tom Lancashire's just run a really fast 1500. I said, and? And he said, well, it was really quick. I went, and? I said, look, Badders, you've just had the best 6 weeks training of your life, correct? Yes or no? Yes. Did you run a really good K time trial in 218, 219? Yes. Is that the fastest you've ever done it? Yes. I said, what more do you need to know?
Yeah.
And he looked at me and went, oh, okay then. Do you know? And that's why, you know, with the athletes, sometimes coaches can say too much when you've done the work. So all you need is just a little bit of reinforcement. You know, coaches, we're a comfort blanket for you guys. You know, we're there. The work's done. You've done the work we've set you. But sometimes you just need that word in your ear, which has said, look, you're good to go. You know, and once you hear just those few words, you don't need to overplay it. You know, you're good to go, or go and enjoy yourself. You know, that's all you need to know sometimes. So when I see coaches giving athletes lectures in the warm-up areas, I'm like, you should have done all of that in the 6 to 8 weeks you had before today. You know, and that's how it works. You know, if I say to you know, to you, Oliver, you know, you've done all the training you need to do, and on race day you look at me and you say, oh, do you know, I don't know if I can do this. It'd be like, are you kidding me? Look, just go and do what you do. You're in a good place. Let's go and do this. That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. Do you think it's sometimes a defense mechanism for when the coaches maybe know the athletes haven't done the work?
Yeah, it can be. It can be. It's funny. I mean, Neil Black, bless his soul, sadly he's not with us anymore. I remember at the Olympics with Badders at London, and he looked at me and because I knew we'd done the training, everything was fine. And we were there in the warm-up area, you know, all the fans are in the stadium, and Badders was warming up, and he looked at me and he said, Andy, you don't look really nervous. And I sort of paused for a bit, and I sort of looked at him. I said, Neil, I'm not fucking running. do you know what I mean? And that's what I'm saying is a coach's job is to prepare the athlete for the race. We're not there to run the race. We're there, and we will be there in the background. You know, if you do need us, we're there. If you need a hug after, we're there. You know, we're a comfort blanket. Our work's done before race day.
Sure. Yeah, I think what Ollie was sort of alluding to was it's more when coaches do waffle and they do like give the lectures pre-race, is that because they're maybe doubtful of the performance their athlete might put
out? I think so. It's their own insecurities coming across. Yeah. You know yourself. You know, if you've got a coach who's nervous or unsure about what you're going to do, that doesn't really help you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas if you're looking across and your coach is having a cup of tea with his mate, having a laugh, and just looks over you and gives you a smile and says, "Yeah, you're good to go," there's no worries, is there? Really?
Yeah.
You know,
it's spot on there. I mean, you know what? What characteristics made Andy such a good 1500 runner? And from you talking about his training, I mean, possibly he could have gone on to be a really good 5K runner as well.
Yeah, and that's perhaps the part of the story that never got to live itself out, really, because we called it a day because of injuries, really.
Yeah.
And that's a sad part of our sport, that sometimes there is an injury that just won't go away. But he had all of the credentials to certainly break 13 for the 5K. You used to run a standard 5K, at the end of the winter season, it would be 13:20, 13:22 for 5K. So he certainly had the credentials to go and run fast. But for him, it's because he was disciplined. He was very disciplined to the cause. He had that mindset, which is, I can do this. And he was prepared to do the work. You know, he did a lot of training and he persevered with the plan to the end. As a coach, I spoke to him every single day. There wasn't a single day that we weren't in contact about how he was feeling, how was his training going. And he was honest with me. You know, he wasn't like telling me what I wanted to hear. He would tell me straight. You know, we had falling outs on occasions if he didn't like a training session. You know, why am I doing this? And I said, well, you'll find out. I don't think I should be doing this. And I said, well, that's up to you. We're doing it. You know, and then later down the line, he might turn around and say, yeah, you were right.
Mm.
You know, that's what makes it a good thing, is when an athlete is honest, an athlete's prepared to do the work. And for him, he just had that intelligence and discipline that allowed him to get on with it. And I think that was key. And he was prepared to stick to the plan, you know?
Mm.
I mean, how many of you guys will talk to athletes and they're forever looking left and right for another quick fix or another option to make them better? Whereas what they should really be doing is just investing in the coach they have and listening to their coach and letting their coach do what they do.
You see it all the time. And I think, you know, in this climate, it's even harder, you know, for athletes to stay on the straight and narrow and listen to their coach, isn't it? Because they just seem to be, you know, even more out there for them to get distracted.
Everyone is turning around and saying they're the next best thing. Yeah. And it kills me. It really does kill me. I can remember in the early days that someone said to me, oh, you know, you're going to have to stop coaching Badders because he's getting too good, because you're not a UKA coach. Yeah. And I said to them, I said, look, do you think I'm stupid? You know, yes, my athlete's improving, but that means I have to read and make myself the next step up. And if I don't do my homework and do my research and do that type of stuff, yeah, he'll have to go to someone else if I can't perform to that level as well.
Mm.
But that's what it takes. You know, you don't just go, oh, well, he's a world-class coach, right? I'll give you my athlete. Why don't you learn with the athlete and basically take them there? Because you have a good relationship with the athlete. That's more important. You know, if you've got a trust in your coach and you've got that relationship as a team, then you can build it. And you can work together and you can be great. But it's not about just going, yeah, I'm going to jump to that coach. Yeah, I want that group or be there. You know, it's about having trust in the process, having trust in the plan, and just let them do what they do. But a lot of people opt out early. I've had athletes, you know, in the past that they've come across and I said to them early on, I said, it's not going to work. And they said, why is it not going to work? I said, because you're looking elsewhere already. I said, you're not trusting in the process. And I'm not going to waste my time and I don't want to waste your time. You need to go somewhere else.
Mm.
You know, that's a great message. Yeah, it's what it takes, isn't it?
Mm. Obviously, we mentioned kind of Andy in the 5K and we have to chat about the park run, of course. It's almost, I don't know, it's almost become one of his most famous achievements, believe it or not. Let's just chat. Obviously, like, do you mind telling the story for people who don't know, like after 2012?
No, look, So let me give you this visualization. All right. So you've worked your butt off to get to the Olympics, your home Olympics. You get through the first round. You go into the semifinals. You miss out on making the final by one place. And to say you're devastated is an understatement. There isn't any coming back from that. I think after the semi-final, we didn't say a word. It was just, you know, it was just, and I think all I said to him at the end of the night was, look, just go and have a beer. I'll chat to you on Monday. I don't find it's good to overanalyze straight after a race. Okay. Yeah. And on Monday, I called him. I said, did you have a good time Sunday? Oh yeah, great. I had a couple of beers. And he still sounded a bit down. He said, so what are we doing this week? And I said, I think we'll do part run on Saturday. and the phone went silent. He went, what? I said, yeah, let's go to park run on Saturday. I'll bring the bike down. I'll pace you around a park run Saturday. There was no mention of world record or anything. It was just, let's go and do a park run. So we had a fairly low-key week, and I turned up at Bushy on the Saturday with the bike, trusty bike. You know, I'm sure James does it, doesn't he? We can't keep up with you guys anymore, so we're on the bike. And it was brilliant because it's the London Home Olympics. You've got everyone there in their GB stuff, the flags and everything else. And it's so funny, at the start of the park run, the organisers suddenly realised Badders was there. So some of these guys have been watching on TV was at their park run. So he said, oh, just let you know, Andy Badley's here. And there's a big cheer, you know, yay! And he walked out to the front and he went, hi, yeah, yeah. I'm halfway down the way, about 200 metres down the way, watching this. And he knows he's got to catch me up and then just follow me around. So imagine that as an athlete feeling really down, you get that home support and that kind of feeling that you're loved and, all of those things which you just need. It's like a big hug from park run that day, you know. Anyway, we set off and I am such a bad coach, but occasionally I lie to my athletes. Okay. So Badders thought we were trying to basically just have a kind of a 14-10, 14-20 type of day. And I had it in my head that we might have a go. So I've got the dog in the background. We might have a go. So we got through the first K and he sort of looked at me and said, are we on pace? I said, no, Bad, you're 5 seconds down. And we got to 2K and he sort of looked across. He was properly going for it. And it looked at me. I said, no, Bad, it's still a few seconds down. You need to pick it up. And that's kind of how it went. We got to 4K, which is where I had to turn off towards the finish. And he sort of looked at me and I said, Matt, you're going to have to pick it up. We're still down. And so he then absolutely buried it through to the finish. And he came through the finish line and he had no idea what time he'd run. And the organizer came over to him and said, you've just run 13:48.
Wow.
And the smile, the hugs, the excitement, the fun, all of those things was the best bit of medicine you could ever give an athlete who had just not made the Olympic final, you know? And all because his coach had lied to him all the way.
Yeah. Did you face criticism for that at all?
In what way?
Were there some cynics out there who were like, oh, you know, he should have made the final, for example, you know, what's he doing chasing a park run a week later?
You know what? If you've got an athlete who's tried their hardest to make a final, then you can't criticize them for having, I mean, to go to a park run, all of you guys know, it's such a community thing.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of elite.
Yeah.
And we were just going there to get a few things out of his system. That's all it was. Yeah, and sometimes you guys need that. You know, I don't know what James does with you guys, but you might send you out for a 15-mile run. Just go and do a long run. You know, we'll chat after. And so this 5K was just an opportunity to just get the upset and the angst and, you know, all of that out of his system. And we did that. So, you know, people might say, why? Well, there was no real reason why, other than to make him feel better and to get over the biggest disappointment of his athletics career.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was a win.
Yeah, it was, and I mean, yeah, the record is pretty much untouchable.
No, I don't think it is.
It seems to be.
No. I think they're given the new technology and shoes at
one thing about parkrun is you've still got to turn up at 9 o'clock on a Saturday. You know, you know, 13:48, obviously, you know, there's people out there now who could probably go and do it, but it's still 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, which I think makes it very hard.
Do you guys not train at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning?
No, you do, but training's different to, you know, going to go and run a flat out 5K, isn't it? But yeah, to be honest, I'm more of an evening afternoon guy.
Yeah, I'm getting that impression. So it gives you time to do your hair.
Yeah. This is it. Look, I mean, I'm sure like when Andy was racing, you might have had this a little bit as well, but I want to talk about his like running style a little bit. Obviously, it was a unique running style. And was running form you worked on at all? You know, did you almost have to defend it? Because sometimes someone may look like they don't have the best running form, but it's very efficient for them.
Look, I'm perhaps the worst for this because literally in the early days of coaching him, we went to do the Hyde Park relays. I'm not sure if they're still going, but anyway, he came past me in a Hyde Park relays. I basically abused him for not going fast enough. All right.
Right. Yeah.
Because he doesn't look like he's going very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think Collis Birmingham used to call him the hovercraft. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, I didn't deserve that abuse. I said, what do you mean? He said, I'll just run the fastest leg.
Yeah.
I went, oh, yeah, fair play. All right. And that was kind of like a quick wake-up call. Did we work on his style? Yes, we did. He was perhaps landing on his strike a little bit ahead of his hips, okay, you know, to begin with. So we had to instill some drills so that he was striking underneath the body as opposed to ahead of the body. Yes, we did that. That took time. Hills have their own way of sorting out biomechanic issues. We did a lot of that. Yeah, we worked on it. But his style played to his advantage because I can remember perhaps in the World University Games 1500 meters final, we had this plan to keep it slow for the first kind of 600 or so, and we were going to kick it in with the last 800. And so he slowed the race. It was a jog. But when he went, they hadn't realized how quick he was going. So they let him go. He closed the last 800 in 1:48.
Wow.
And it was only, was it Heshko that managed to get past him?
Mm.
So it can look perhaps as it does, but it can also be very advantageous because you are in fact moving a lot quicker than people believe. Mm. But we worked on it, and I'm sure you guys have this as well, but you know, sometimes an athlete can have a style that doesn't tick all the boxes or fit with how it's supposed to fit. But if it's efficient and it works, leave it alone.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what's that buzzword that we hear a lot these days? Cadence. Mm. You know, your cadence must be this. You know, your stride is too short. You're not doing this. You're not doing that. Well, sod that. If you've got a high cadence and it means that you're running efficiently and it works for you, leave it alone.
Mm.
You know, I'm a fan. If a runner is happy with how they're running and it works for them, and there's not too much wrong with it that's going to cause them injuries, then yeah, crack on.
Yeah, for sure.
We can't all look as sweet as the Kenyans do floating around the track.
I think that we see with the Kenyans in the steeplechase, that like we often get commentators or anyone really kind of suggesting that the Kenyan steeplechasers could work on their technique a bit more. But actually, if you watch how they maybe not hurdle the jump, but how they jump over them, it is extremely efficient for them.
Yeah, look, you know, come on, guys. If it works for you, I mean, if you're the world champion and perhaps you don't run pretty, who cares? You're the world champion. You know, you can have those runners, and I'm sure you've got people in your own training groups who've got a lovely running style, but that's all it is. It's a lovely running style. There's nothing behind it.
Yeah.
You know, so, it's good to have a good running action. It's good to have a running action that doesn't get you injured. But if you haven't got the engine and the mental hunger to succeed behind it, then it's just a pretty running action.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I think we just want to sort of, you know, summarize and just sort of say, you know, how has your coaching developed over time? If it has at all, you know, from the like when you were young coaching badly, you know, have you changed at all, or do you still stick by, you know, most of those principles?
Okay, look, as coaches, we're forever learning, and we're forever debunking new ideas that come into our sport. Yeah. You know, people come up with suggestions that this is a better way to train. Well, I'll read it, I'll study it, I'll look at it and decide if it works for us. You know, it's about cutting and pasting your training, your coaching over the years to ensure that your athletes are doing the right work, the best work to help them to succeed. So, yeah, I would say, look, I am apologizing now to those athletes I coached early in my career. So Mark Draper was my first athlete. Poor Mark, he will tell you many, many stories about how we had a lot of fun in our training. And if you were to look at how I coached then through to where I am now, it is very different. But that's because I've got the benefit of 25 years of coaching behind me. I've made a lot of mistakes. You learn from your mistakes. And by learning from your mistakes, then you benefit the athletes you're now coaching. So I have changed a lot, and I'm no longer in a rush. I will take my time. I will. I'm lucky to have worked with some great athletes and spoken to some very great coaches over the years, so that I'm perhaps a more rounded coach now. And I like that. And I think my athletes like it as well. I'm a lot more chilled out.
Do you think you've got any characteristics that have kind of stayed with you from the start there? Is there anything that, obviously you mentioned how you've changed a lot and developed. Is there anything that you think still runs true that you probably had, what, like 25 years ago, like you said?
Yeah, look, I've always been a fan of mileage, but, you know, progressive mileage. So I'm very much old school in that. You know, I grew up in the co-over era. You know, I used to be in the Royal Air Force with Steve Jones, Julian Gota, those types of guys. So I knew that those guys put the work in. And so I realized that, you know, mileage is a good thing, but it's subjective again. You know, 50 miles for one person could be another person's 100 miles. So I believe in putting the work in. I believe in twice a day training when you're ready for it. I believe that you do need an S&C program, which runs alongside your running program. You need to be holistic about how you evolve with an athlete. It's organic. You progress as the athlete is able to progress. So that's kind of my philosophy with coaching, and I've stuck with that from the beginning to where I am now. Look, if you're prepared to put the work in and you're fortunate enough to have a coach who's prepared to put the work in with you, then you're very lucky. And you should work with that coach and trust that coach. Because as a team, you can do anything. And if it means that you have happy memories that you can sit back on when you're sat down with your kids and your wife and you're having a pint of beer or whatever, and you've got a smile on your face, then that's a good thing.
Yeah. Andy, where are you? What's your typical week look like just right now? Yeah.
Well,
you're working full time. You know,
okay. So
coaching,
look.
Yeah.
Okay. So look, I'm a criminal lawyer. Been doing that for 27 years. So I'm in court or at police stations most days. I'm going to the police station after this. I have three kids. My kids are now 15, 14, and 10. So my eldest Oliver has kind of grown up with athletes coming around the house. So he's actually a runner. He's actually starting to enjoy his running now. So it's quite cool, but I don't coach him. All right.
You have a kid.
Yes. So somebody else coaches him, but I mentor that coach. So it's all right. My kids have got activities. So they've got three activities each. So I'm a rugby coach as well. I coach at the local running club here, which is Hearts Phoenix, on a Tuesday and Thursday. So I mentor the coaches there. Somewhere along the line, I have a wife that I see. That's it, really. We have fun. It's mad. I coach at the weekend as well. Yeah, it's madness, but I love it. And there isn't a day goes by that I don't talk to my athletes, whether it's WhatsApp or on the phone. I'm one of those sad old bastards who I love what we do. You know, I really do love what we do. I've, you know, and if it's helped some of my athletes to have some great achievements, then it's fantastic. But I'm just that type of coach. I just love what I do and I enjoy what you guys do. It's a good thing.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, me and Ollie have got to say thanks for coming on, and obviously thank you for being such a, you know, key member of the running community in this country.
No, look, you guys are awesome, and keep doing the good work.